Yep, I see. Oh, this is some Marjorie Vander Schaff. No. I see you. I see you. Yeah. And there you go. And you just need to turn your camera on. See yourself.
Okay, can you see me now?
Yeah, hang up the phone, so there you go.
Okay.
Oh, good to see you.
So I'm gonna leave it open like this. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So I saw the format that you have.
Yes.
So when you ask me the questions,
yes,
when do I get to tell my story?
So the question that we have for you is that we do the introductions up front, and
right,
then I have, you're a heart doctor. You certainly seen the number
right
of cases, etc.
Right.
Did you think you got COVID because it was so widespread? It was unavoidable. And then you
right
start off and then tell your story
okay
when you want.
Gotcha. Right. Gotcha.
It's a very...
The foundation of the Northumberland Hill Hospital, IM Care, the community health centers of Northumberland, and the Northumberland Family Health Team. So this started off a while ago as a practice improvement project, but then it has grown over the last 5 years. And the key players behind this are Jennifer Gillard from NHH, Jennifer Gilmer from the Northumberland Foundation, Taryn Renix from the Community Health Center, Katie Conti and Bill Prevecki, who are the PFAC or patient family advisors, who also participate in helping us pick the topics, and Adrian Bell-Smith from the Northumberland Family Health Team. So so that is who is behind these. Today's talk is essentially three major speakers who are spotlighted on your screen. Dr. Paul Ketoff, he's our emergency, one of our emergency room physicians, who has been through us for a few years, but throughout the pandemic. And he jokingly said this is the first time he's put on a shirt because otherwise he's in scrubs most of the time. Dr. Michael Berry, he is has been a longtime physician at Northumberland. He is also one of our anesthesiologists, and he takes care of the sickest of the sick, the things that you hear people on ventilators and others. So we'll have a perspective from him. And thirdly, is somebody from United States, Dr. Madhav Rao. He is known to me through my family connections. He lives in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He's a cardiologist, and his story is that of a physician as well as a survivor from COVID. He has gone through it from many different angles. So we said we should have here a patient perspective too, and so that is him. So in essence, what are PACE talks? PACE stands for Personalized Assessment and Change Education. These are moderated talks. One of us moderates them. Today it is my privilege to moderate this group. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Mukesh Vargava. I'm an internal medicine specialist. I also double up as chief of staff at NHH. And this is one of my passion projects with the team that I mentioned. So this started in 2015, and we have been, this is our sixth year. We talked about the supporters. Here are the key features of this. These are talks or conversations that are not supported by anybody in terms of money or dollars. So no money is paid to the speakers. Everybody volunteers. There is literally a zero cost footprint of this effort. Topics are suggested by you, the audience, and topics reflect integrative medicine, meaning that not just, you know, traditional medicine, but other things. And our traditional way of doing this is the speaker speaks for 20 to 25 minutes, followed by an open question and answer sessions, followed by a 10-minute general remarks. on any topic, people can ask questions. But today is going to be slightly different because we have three speakers. So it is almost like a panel because of the way the topic is structured. This is not, I'll tell you what it is not, because that is important. This is not a conversation about government funding, you know, how the system works, hospital policy, et cetera. This is not that the speakers are providing treatment advice. These are conversation starters that you may have questions or thoughts, and no solicitation or marketing of services is allowed. So that is my role, that we make sure that this is not like an advertisement for somebody. So it is really a pure, as much of a purest way of having conversation. And so that is what are the principles of PACE Talk. Today's topic is a general COVID conversation from different perspectives. I'll ask a few questions as conversation starters and then turn it over to the audience to ask questions. So I'll start with Paul. You have been with us in the pandemic for the entire time, since the first patient walked in to NHH. And I clearly remember that day when we heard that somebody is coming who had been in China, and we were like, oh, this is here, and how do we get ready? So you have seen through a lot. How has your approach when somebody comes into the emergency room and you have no idea what they have, what has changed for you?
Thanks, Mukesh, and thank you everyone for being here. It's an interesting question, and I've had a few seconds to reflect on that. And when I think about it, I think it's very hard to put into a small paragraph, but I think there's a few components that we've done together in the ER. I mean, the ER is the front door of the hospital. We see everybody who walks in through the door. And I think our general sense of care and our general sense of low threshold of suspicion is certainly increased. You know, we treat everybody who has any cold to cough symptoms or any infectious symptoms more carefully. We isolate earlier now because we're also there to protect the other patients in the department that are maybe sitting, you know, down the hallway from the patient that has got the cough and cold. We've implemented very stringent cleaning protocols in the ER. All the touch surfaces get cleaned throughout the day. We have safety protocols in terms of anything that's touched by patients or by staff. When you and I started working about the universal masking policy, you know, in the very beginning of the pandemic, the fact that we've been very stringent about masking everybody who works in the hospital, in the ER, but also everybody who walks in through the door, visitor or patient. So I think the general low threshold of being more careful, isolating people earlier until we know more. That has been the big change in our ER. The challenging thing about that has been the fact that sometimes we have delays. You know, if I walk out of the room with somebody who's got a cough and cold type symptoms, I don't know. They're undifferentiated at that time. They don't have the swab back. I'm also there to protect the next patient I see. So I may take a little longer to change and to make sure I don off my PPE correctly. So the biggest challenge that I've seen that we've encountered is just general communication with the families, because they're also not allowed in the emergency department during the pandemic because of the visitation policy. We make exceptions to patients who can't speak for themselves or are too confused. So we've tried to sort of mitigate that by calling families on the phone and talking with them. Sometimes our nurses do. If I'm too busy with a sick patient, then our nurses communicate with the families to update them on what's been going on in the care. And we've just reflected on that, interestingly enough, just a few weeks ago before I heard about this PACE Talk, about what hasn't changed. And what hasn't changed for us is just because somebody has cough and cold symptoms doesn't change our care for other things. If somebody comes in, have a cold and cough type symptoms, but also my clinical impressions that they've got a heart attack, they get the same speediness of care and the same level of care as pre-COVID. We just do it with proper precautions and isolations, and being available there for everybody who has got respiratory symptoms, but also for everybody else who's coming with other symptoms is our key priority in the ER.
Thank you. So clearly, Paul, what you're saying is your work has not only been different that you need to protect yourself, but it takes longer to transition between one patient and the other. And more importantly, that if somebody has COVID but has another medical problem like a heart problem or others, you still provide speedy and efficacious care. It is not like, oh my God, you have COVID. And
yeah, and that's been our priority in the emergency department always, and that hasn't changed. And if they also have cough and cold symptoms, we're isolating the patients appropriately. We're swabbing everybody that comes in, gets admitted, and we still treat the other aspects of their care.
Right. So, Michael, you are an anesthesiologist. You initiate life support on people with your team. You get close to people and you get close to their respiratory tract, and you have, you know, these secretions, and you don't know what the patient may have for infections. How has your team and you personally have changed to protect yourself and still provide life-saving care while you are getting close to people? You're muted, Michael.
There, can you hear me now?
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here and to see everyone come out to listen to us. In terms of our approach to patients with COVID, and you know, when I reflect back on the start of this pandemic, there was certainly a lot of anxiety, you know, globally about this pandemic, but certainly in you know, healthcare environments, especially frontline care workers like myself, who, and we're used to dealing with secretions, we're used to dealing with, you know, bodily fluids. So we're trained in doing our job and keeping ourselves safe. But COVID presented a lot of new challenges, and this stems from the fact that it's just so contagious. I think about seeing, you know, images from East Africa of healthcare workers dealing with Ebola, and I thought, oh my gosh, like, look at them, they're wearing spacesuits. How crazy is that? And here we are now, 2020, and we're essentially approaching COVID like diseases like Ebola have been approached in other parts of the world. We were fortunate here in Northumberland County and at this hospital that we had some time to prepare, that we weren't inundated with disease early on, and we took that time and utilized it. And I was part of a team that we reviewed donning and doffing, putting on personal protective equipment, and use of personal protective equipment. Most healthcare workers, as I mentioned, are well versed in wearing this, but it's not something that the degree of personal protective equipment we've never really had to wear routinely. And now with COVID, it's become routine. So we did training early on in the pandemic. We actually did rehearsals. Some of us who are more intimate, I guess, with patients in what we do in terms of managing the airway where it's higher risk, We took this small group of healthcare workers, respiratory therapists and nurses and some of the physicians, and we did rehearsals in donning and doffing personal protective equipment. Because something we learned from the SARS epidemic was that healthcare workers that did get SARS, that were inflicted with it, most often they caught it because of improper use of personal protective equipment. So we really wanted to stress that we need to have a systematic approach to putting on personal protective equipment and taking it off. So it was one thing we did. Another thing was just thinking through what we needed to do when we entered a room to deal with a patient with COVID. And as you mentioned, you know, we're providing life supports. We're putting breathing tubes in, something called intubating. We're putting in tubes into different places. It's quite invasive what we do. It takes time. So we really needed to have a systematic approach to going into a patient's room, having our PPE on properly, having all the equipment with us so we weren't entering and leaving a room and perhaps contaminating other areas of the hospital. So we organized, basically we used Rubbermaid tubs and we filled them with everything we needed. So when we got the call to go in and deal with someone who was critical, we would just roll in all the equipment we needed. We closed the door and we did what we needed to do. And then we would exit the room and we'd be supervised doffing or taking off the equipment. Because again, that was one of the high risk things. So we had to put a lot of thought into these processes. The other thing we needed to do is remind ourselves to slow down, that unfortunately, even when, historically when there's an arrest, a cardiac arrest or something critical happens, everyone just runs and rushes into the room and it's all hands on deck. We had to change that mindset because we can't just run into a patient's room with COVID unprotected. Even if that person was struggling to breathe and was moribund or, potentially, dying, that we had to take the time to protect ourselves, to protect our team, because we knew that, we have to be there for the community, for everyone else. We have to protect ourselves, our families. So that had to be a priority. So we had to slow down the way we react and not, drag ourselves, but we certainly had to be very focused on how we approach patients. So that was a big change in how we do business.
Right. Oh, thank you, Michael. And when Michael says that donning and doffing, that is literally, donning means how do you put on things and doffing means how do you take off. And when the training was going on, it was like, what's the big deal? How to take off gloves and how to take off a gown. And now we have realized it is an art and you have to be very mindful of what you take, what you put on in what sequence, because that can really affect the proper use of things. So now it has become second nature, but the nursing team, the infection control personnel at the hospital really put in a lot of effort in certifying within, I think it was under a week, right, Michael, that we got everybody at NHH trained how to put on and take off and PPE, which we thought would be, and we all have that sticker. So Paul, you work in the emergency room and you have seen people with coronavirus. Sometimes you have suspected they didn't have it. Sometimes you didn't suspect they may have had it. What did you expect in March that would happen? But what did really happen? And what was the things that were sort of, geez, I didn't think this will happen, other than how long it has lasted? What would you say?
How long it has lasted certainly wasn't expected.
Right.
I've been at the NHH for quite a few years now. My previous work was all within GTA, and most of my colleagues who I know from back in the day work within GTA hospitals. So my expectation was probably a stronger first wave. And I only work at NHH, and I'm actually quite proud to be part of this community, because the one unexpected thing for me was when I was seeing patients during the first wave coming in for other concerns. And of course, when you take your history, you ask your questions about exposure and other people. And people would tell me from our community, no, doctor, I have not left my house, or I have been very careful, or my son is dropping off groceries. And it was actually quite heartwarming and quite shocking and made me proud to be a part of our community, because I think people took the advice from the government seriously and people have isolated and been careful. And I think that's actually responsible to the fact that we were able to keep our numbers low as long as we did. I think that was the key to that, is the fact that the community listened. That was certainly unexpected, and made me more proud to be part of the Northumberland community. The other thing with the disease itself, I think the biggest challenge is the fact that it's unpredictable. I mean, I've seen people who are young who are unwell and need to stay in the hospital. I've certainly seen people who are elderly and have comorbidities who are doing quite well despite the infection and clinically appeared well and were able to be discharged home and go home. So I think from a virus perspective, the difference in presentation was unexpected. And from the community perspective, the very robust positive response was pleasantly unexpected.
Right. No, that is, I would say, I'd agree that the way all of you, the attendees, our community, the way you have put up with the challenges, the restrictions and the things is just really very appreciated because it is not the same in other countries, in other places, where the general population has been so receptive. And we owe it to you. And often when people say that these are frontline workers, I think all of us are in frontline when we are fighting this. When you put on a mask, when you socially distance, you have done your part as any one of us would do. Michael, you have seen some of almost all of the cases that have gone through NHH. Is there a feeling that when there are two equally sick people and you think, gee, these have equal sickness, one does better and the other doesn't? Do you have a feeling or a sense? Is it the attitude of the person? It is. What is it that some people respond better or surprise you?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, COVID certainly is a different entity than what I've seen as a physician, that most of us have seen. You know, I think Paul said it, that you know, there's a lot of unknowns, and we really don't understand it well enough. Like, we understand things like pneumonia, we understand influenza, we kind of can predict the course of illness in a patient based on what the pathogen is, what that bug is that they're fighting, and, you know, what their baseline health is and what comorbidities, what other illnesses they have. But COVID has presented different challenges. You know, I've been surprised, you know, very happily surprised that some people I've seen with COVID have just shook it off, despite having some underlying medical conditions. But for the most part, sadly, I think, you know, COVID is, it's a bad disease. And if I've been very surprised, well, not as surprised anymore, but initially to see patients come in, you know, to look at their x-ray, to look at their blood work, to go and talk to them, go in their room and see, you know, yeah, they're struggling to breathe a bit, but just how quickly they can deteriorate. And, you know, I had one very critical patient who unfortunately had some significant underlying health issues, heart and lung issues, had COVID. And, you know, I talked to her in the afternoon. I was in her room and she was, you know, in good spirits. She was actually the day before, I was told she was on Facebook. And then, you know, a few hours later, I was called back and, you know, I had to intubate her and put her on a ventilator. And unfortunately, she succumbed. You know, if that was just a community acquired pneumonia or influenza, I would have been completely shocked to see someone deteriorate that quickly. But now COVID has taught me that, you know, it can go sour, it can go downhill really quickly. And we tend to, our threshold to intervene now, it seems to be much lower with COVID than it was with, you know, influenza or even, you know, community acquired pneumonias.
Right. No, thank you. No, I would certainly say that in these situations, the patient is worried what will happen to them, but the doctor is worried, the nurses are worried, because it is unpredictable. We have this anxiety that when will this person get worse? Paul had asked me to admit somebody just this past weekend, and the person had improved in the emergency room, and he said, but we should still watch him more closely. They might deteriorate, and we did. And this is something that where, because of the unknown speed of progression, we change. We have also seen people very, very compliant with what to do. So talking about patients, Madhav, you are a heart doctor, you're a cardiologist in the United States. United States has clearly had a much larger disease burden than, fortunately, Canada. When you saw the pandemic, you were going, seeing the patients, and then did you think that you got COVID just because there was such a big burden of disease around you and you were out there taking care of people. Tell us what happened and what's your story. But it is good to see you smiling and after COVID. So you're on mute. Just unmute yourself. There you go.
Okay. Mukesh, thank you for having me on the panel. It was quite an experience. As a cardiologist, I was always busy and use your PPE and take care of the patients with COVID without any problem. And as other speakers indicated, we learned pretty quickly how to prevent in the hospital. And we were taught how to do the PPE in a proper way. And mask was a mandatory thing. Social distancing was mandatory. The only time you take your mask off is when you're eating in the office or in the kitchen. So otherwise, we were very strict. And when we had the initial spike sometime in April, we were a little bit behind New York State and we were not too bad. But as the months progressed, we had the second spike. And right after the Thanksgiving, that's when they predicted there's going to be a bigger spike. I never thought that I would get COVID. I think there are two reasons for that. Number one, definitely the number of cases have gone up in Pennsylvania as it has gone up in United States. So there is a higher positivity rate in the community. That's number one. Number two, when the bars were all closed, the restaurants were closed. In fact, they predicted that this is going to be a spread among the family, small gatherings at home. So I think that's what happened to me. And I was extremely careful and I never had a problem until we went to a family friend's house. That was a big mistake we did. And we had the host and their daughter came in from Philadelphia. So little we knew that this woman was going to the bars and meeting with friends, going to the gym. And a few days later, we started getting sick. First, my wife started getting very sick and she thought it was a sinusitis. She was having terrible headaches, extreme fatigue. And a few days later, I was started having chills and extreme fatigue and sore throat and some body aches. And we got tested and I was positive for COVID. So obviously, I was quarantined. I had to stay away from work and I was talking to my infectious disease friends, and they suggested that I should monitor my temperature at home. I was not short of breath, and I had a pulse oximetry, and I was monitoring my oxygen saturation. Believe it or not, for 5 days, I had no problem, just body aches, extreme fatigue, and sore throat. And around the sixth day, I became very ill. Just walk into the bathroom, I could see my heart pounding and my pulse rate would go up to 130. And talking was a very laborious thing. I could not breathe and I could not take a deep breath. The chest was hurting and I was progressively getting worse within 2 days. So we had to call the ambulance and I went to the hospital. In the hospital, the good news was, my saturation had dropped from 98 to 92, 93%. So they did not put me on any supplemental oxygen. I had the standard treatment with steroids, Decadron, and also I received remdesivir. Within a couple of days of treatment, I markedly improved. The first thing that improved was my fatigue. And I had a very low grade temperature, but the breathing took a little while. And every time I talked or took a deep breath or walked to the bathroom, it would hurt and I would be very short of breath. And after 5 days, I came home and it took me about a month to gradually improve to come to the stage that I'm in right now. And the biggest problem is the fatigue. And a lot of people feel that they have a loss of taste, loss of smell. I didn't have any of those things. I did not have a high temperature, but I did have body aches and sore throat. And I've never been sick like this in my life. And To answer your second question, was it unavoidable? The answer is definitely yes. And in fact, CDC warned that there is going to be a spike between Thanksgiving and Christmas. They also predicted that the case load will increase, not because of going to the restaurant or bars, small family gatherings, wherein you have, you know, 10 people or less. So that's exactly what happened to me. So fortunately, I recovered, and this was the worst illness I ever had. And subsequently, I did get my first vaccine. And the best treatment for this thing is prevention. And you cannot overemphasize, you know, masking and also social distancing. And we don't realize that small social gatherings can be really very risky at this time. Until everybody's vaccinated, if we can follow masking and also social distancing and avoid social gathering, I think that we can do a remarkable control of the virus. Keep in mind, the virus cannot survive without human beings. So unless you have human contact, you will not be able to get the virus.
Thank you, Madhav. And you know, when I first heard about that you got COVID and I heard the story, you were a person exercising on a treadmill and doing things for 30, 40 minutes of the day. And when you were discharged from the hospital, you came home on a walker. I was like, oh my God, this is really, it ages you fast, but you have recovered and you're looking good. So thank you. So all three of you, Paul, Michael, Madhav, you have had different perspectives. You've looked at it from different things. You're also, you all have family, you have kids at home and those. If you were to say, what would be the key learnings that you would want to pass to everybody? If there was a one point that you would say, and we'll start with you, Michael, what is one thing you would say to everybody, your family, your friends, this group, your colleagues?
Well, I think the one thing I would say is, you know, we still have to be hypervigilant. You know, it's, you know, we've all experienced this COVID fatigue now that, you know, it's several months into the pandemic. Everyone had this seriousness about the pandemic back in, you know, March, April, when we didn't really know what was going on and it was spreading globally. And I feel, and even now I'm witnessing things that shouldn't happen. You know, gatherings that shouldn't happen, you know, even people that aren't wearing masks where they should. And we're fortunate in this county, in this area, that we don't have the same degree burden of disease that in other areas, but we just can't let our guard down. You know, I have four boys and they plead with us, you know, can we have so-and-so over? Can we do this? And, you know, they're fighting with each other and they just want to be with their friends. And, you know, I say, you know, we can't let you socialize. We can't go places. They want to go skiing. They want to do this. I think we have to weather the storm as a society and be hypervigilant and think not about ourselves as much as the most vulnerable people in society, and the fact that if we bring it home or contract it, that we're probably going to give it to other people that might not have as good of outcome as we might dealing with this disease.
Thank you. Madhav, what would be your key learning? I know you have shared that don't, you know, socialize at this point. What else would you say is the key learning?
Well, I would reemphasize, do not underestimate this illness and why some people are very sick, why some people have very mild symptoms, why some people are asymptomatic spreaders. We don't know. We don't know a lot about this disease, and we are learning every single day. So having said that, number one, recognize the symptoms. Even if it is minor symptoms, get tested. And if you get tested, if you are positive, be vigilant. Monitor yourself very closely at home, because at this point, there is really no good treatment to be taken at home because the antibodies are not widely available. So symptom recognition and watching for the progression of the disease is a very important thing. It took about 5-6 days for me to get severely symptomatic. So this can happen anytime. It doesn't have to happen on the day one. So be very vigilant, monitor yourself very closely at home. And if you recognize that you're not doing well, especially if you're having trouble breathing, go to the hospital immediately. As far as the prevention part is concerned, I cannot overemphasize. I let my guards down and I went to my friend's house, gathering of about 8 people. So that was a big mistake. So until we are all immunized, prevention is the best way, masking is the best way, and social distancing, and avoid social gathering as much as possible.
Thank you, Madhav. That is very telling. And the one thing that I will put in is, if you get tested or if you are positive and you are being monitored at home, our paramedics in Northumberland County and our nurses from the Lynn, we have a home monitoring program that you can be enrolled in, where your oxygen, your temperature, and things, people will check on you. So literally, we have partnered with folks to bring a little bit of the hospital into your home. And there is capacity. And fortunately, we don't have to use that often, but you can be monitored. You're not alone in your home, just checking yourself. So Paul, what would be your one key message?
I might cheat and maybe do two messages.
Sure.
You know, the first message is really the same. I think as we know, masking and distancing seems to be doing the job in our county. And I think my personal opinion is that that's the responsible thing to do. And also the reason that we have experienced such a lower number during the first wave. I think being vigilant, paying attention. Michael is right. We've all experiencing this, you know, pandemic fatigue where we think, oh, what if we just go out, or, you know, what if we go see other people? I think being vigilant right now is the most important thing, because we're in this push to get the vaccine out of the population. And that really is a better solution. Now, realistically, maybe shutdowns are not the best option. And I think everybody understands it, but that is where we're at right now. So I think if we all follow the rules, be vigilant, I think that is the thing to do for us. The second thing is, in our community, outside of COVID, I mean, we have a generally quite elderly and complex population. And I think the other thing that has bothered me as an emergency physician is the fact that, especially during the first wave, so many diseases became unchecked or missed. And then we were seeing a large number of patients with non-COVID symptoms, non-COVID disease, that were presenting quite late to the emergency department. That made it much more challenging to manage them, made it harder for them. So be vigilant, of course, but also don't hesitate to come to the emergency department if you are sick for other reasons. You know, if you're having belly pain, chest pain, all the other, you know, other reasons to come to the hospital, we will never close. We're always going to be there. And, you know, finding that balance between making sure that we see everybody who needs to be seen timely, like we did pre-COVID, and also maintaining isolation is important. And then if you do have symptoms, whether you've been tested or not, because sometimes public health now will say, don't get tested if your symptoms are mild, just isolate. Isolate until you have no symptoms, even if your test is negative. Because even if your test is negative, but you're still having a fever and a cough and respiratory symptoms, it could be that this is not COVID and you're still infectious with a regular influenza or cold. So isolate until you have no symptoms and stay home and be vigilant.
Great. No, thank you. So you can start putting in your questions in the chat box, or you can raise your hand or unmute and speak. And one question before we open it up for questions is, what is a good thing that has come out of this pandemic when you see our healthcare system, or anything? What has anything good come out of the pandemic that you can pinpoint? And Paul, why don't we start with you? And you're on mute at the moment. Yep, go ahead.
I think for us, the way that the hospital responded, and Michael and Mukesh, you know, we've all been on those committees in the very beginning of the pandemic, how quickly I think the hospital and the community responded. And we had, you know, plan Bs and plan Cs for expansion in case we had a big wave. In the past, I think that would have taken a much longer time to plan for. And I think the fact that everybody sort of worked as a team in the medical community and in our hospital particularly to try to expedite some things, work through the procedures, work through these simulations that we did for codes that are protected, work through the PPE and the donning and donning. The fact that that was all expedited, I think that was a positive thing, because now we can take that and learn from that in the future once this thing is over, to talk about in our teams, in our emergency department teams, you know, what do we do right? And how can we learn from that and bring that to the future and be as expedient and as flexible? Because if there's one thing for this disease, it's flexibility has been key, because it is so unknown and came so suddenly.
Right. So the speed of change, the nimbleness of the hospital and the team was really powerful to you. What about you, Madhav? You and your hospital saw a lot of change, a lot more cases. Anything good come in the United Yes. States because of the pandemic?
Absolutely. In fact, when we started seeing patients sometime in March and April, we were really not prepared. And now the hospital is very well prepared. And also one good thing that came out of this pandemic, the dedication of the healthcare workers. The healthcare workers have really learned a lot and they step up and took care of the patients. As a patient, I can tell you, I had the best possible care in the hospital. So I cannot overemphasize the healthcare personnel have really learned very fast and they're very dedicated. And that's the best thing that came out of this pandemic.
Yeah, great. Michael, what stands out for you as the positive?
Well, a couple of things. I kind of echo my colleagues, and you know, it was very heartwarming to see the community kind of step up right away and support us as healthcare workers, whether it was, you know, leaving little painted rocks near the entrance, or, you know, we had a company, I wanted to show this, that donated these personal air purifying respirators, which are units that we use in the high risk areas, the hot zones for high-risk procedures like intubating. We had a company that just stepped up and said, here, take these, we're not using them. I had friends that reach out to me that were in engineers in academia, and they're like, let us manufacture face shields, 3D print face shields. We just had this outpouring of support. So that's one aspect. Other things, just every day I see little signs, just everyone in society, just at least in this area, for the most part, really making an effort to do what they're told. And, you know, I'm walking down the road, and if someone's on the sidewalk, you know, it's almost awkward who's going to move furthest away. But in the past, it would almost seem like insulting. But now you're just thankful that everyone's just cognizant of the disease prevalence and want to do their part to protect themselves and protect one another. Other things, you know, we talk about healthcare workers and you know what healthcare workers are doing, but a big shout out to other people in the community, you know, the people who work at grocery stores and people who work at Tim Hortons. You know, we can't function without these people, and in many ways they're at higher risk than we are in the hospital, because they're facing so many people every day. And they don't have the same level of PPE that we have. So, you know, to see these people still going to work, knowing that they're potentially going to expose themselves to this virus, it is heartwarming. And I certainly appreciate living in a place like I live in.
No, thank you. And I would say that the generosity of everybody with their patients has been tremendous. Like how, you know, people get admitted to the hospital and then you can visit them, how the community has been tolerant. Everybody has been focused on trying to find a solution and putting up with what would be considered an inconvenience or almost unacceptable in 2019. In 2021 is, okay, we got to deal with this the best we can. So I think there's things that have come out with this. I certainly appreciate how quickly the system has moved with some of the changes that it had to make. So I'll open it up for questions and I'll read some of the questions. And the first one, Michael, why don't you take it, because you are sort of expert at PPE. The question is, and I'll abbreviate it a little bit, is I see a lot of folks, including politicians and others, taking off their masks, folding them, putting them in their pocket, and handling them constantly, putting them back on. But what is the professional view of what is the best way to wear a mask in the community?
Well, I'm no expert, infectious disease expert, but certainly the science is there that we know that this virus can live on surfaces for, you know, at least 48 to 72 hours or perhaps longer. And even textiles, so clothing, including masks. So we have to be cognizant of that. So it's not good practice to be, you know, taking your mask off and touching at least the side that's exposed to everyone else, putting it in your pocket and then taking it out and putting it back on. So I think, you know, the key is, you know, you keep your mask on, and when you take your mask off, you're careful not to touch the surfaces that have been exposed, and you wash your hands. And, you know, that's the key, is I keep hand sanitizer in my truck and, you know, at the entrance to my house. And, you know, I'm just constantly washing my hands. If I have to touch my mask, then I'm washing my hands before I'm putting it on and taking it off. So that'll mitigate the risk.
Now, Paul, you want to add to that anything about mask hygiene?
I would just echo that. Touching the outside of the mask is certainly exposing other people's droplets that could be on the outside of the mask that the mask has caught. So personally, the way we do it in our household, when, you know, I have a mask that I put on, I don't really take it off at all until I get back home. I have sanitizer in the car, sanitizer at the hospital, sanitizer at the front door, and just try to sort of limit any touching of your face with the mask on. You know, if you're out grocery shopping, for instance, you know, I always think of grocery shopping being the high risk activity now. And I think it's impossible to really ensure that all surfaces are clean. That's just reality, right? So if I have a mask on before I leave the car to go to the grocery store, I don't touch my face at all. I touch whatever I need to touch in the grocery store, follow the rules, come back home. And until I'm back home and sanitize my hands, or in the car, sanitize my hands, I don't touch. And if I do touch the mask, I touch the outside loops and sort of put it down without touching the face. And we sanitize our groceries.
Great. I'm going to skip the question about why is Health Canada not approved vaccines, because that is sort of something that we can't solve and we don't have the expertise. Move on to the next two questions, and I'll phrase it as a clinical question to Paul. Paul, if somebody came in who said, I was diagnosed with COVID, I was recovered with COVID, and they came in again, could they be reinfected? Would you test them again? What is the science behind reinfection or getting COVID again? Is the question from Kamlesh and Richard.
I think the science on reinfection is actually still developing. You know, reading some of the papers from the UK and some of the papers from New York after they had their big spikes in reinfection rates, it doesn't seem like reinfection is a huge deal, because if you take the general number of people that have been infected in the States and the number of reinfection, if it was as infectious and, you know, the disease burden would be the same from a different variant, we should be seeing a much bigger spike. That being said, I don't know. We don't really know ourselves. From an ER perspective, I treat everybody who's got respiratory symptoms the exact same way, whether or not they've had COVID, been tested, not tested. So yes, I would retest them. I don't see a lot of, perhaps there's not a lot of validity in retesting them, but I don't see a lot of harm in retesting them. and I would treat them as any other respiratory disease. I would tell them to isolate and monitor themselves. And whether they've had COVID before doesn't make a difference. We certainly have seen a much lower number of influenza this year, just historically compared to other years in NHHER, but we're still seeing symptoms that are classic for influenza. So up until lately, we haven't been testing for influenza for our inpatients. So we don't know. I mean, the story sounds like influenza as opposed to COVID. But anybody who's got symptoms, infectious symptoms, you treat them exactly the same, whether or not they've had COVID before.
Oh, thank you. And if people are admitted now to a hospital and they have a COVID test, we actually test for COVID plus the other viruses, so which is called multiplex. So we are testing for five. So we'll know more about this. The next one actually is a comment from Adrian Bellsmith, who runs our Northumberland Family Health Team. She said, one good thing that has come out of the pandemic is better access to care in some ways and some services through virtual care. And we'll likely have a session soon on virtual care. So Deborah McCarthy said, good thing from the pandemic, because of the recommended behaviors, the incidence of the flu has decreased, just like what Paul was saying. So yes, that is true. And then I have a question. This is from Jennifer Darrell. We are very fortunate that we live in a community that is not densely populated, is relatively cooperative in observing the guidelines, and should also recognize that our hospital has worked hard to be prepared and get information out there. So thank you, Jennifer, for that encouragement. And John Matthew asked, is the vaccine in the county yet? And I can say the answer is no, not yet, but coming soon. And we don't have a date, but we expect it somewhere in February. That is what our health unit has told. Stay tuned for that. Then it is a comment from Jennifer Gillard from NHH. Well said, Dr. Berry. This takes a whole community to confront, and we are so fortunate to live in this one. Ainsley McNaught asks, any tips for essential workers on staying safe / reducing spread going to and from work in addition to masks and social distancing? So I'll frame it. What do you guys do after you leave the hospital to protect your family and children?
I can probably speak to that. I have three sets of clothes. I have home clothes, I have grocery clothes, and I have hospital clothes. So when I leave the hospital, the mask gets changed. I wear a different mask to and from the doors of the hospital. And I only put on the clothes that I only travel from my home to the hospital in. Those clothes go in a bin when I get home and be isolated from the rest of the from my clothes, and they get washed whenever they get washed. And then if I go out to a grocery store, for any essential shopping, I put on a separate set of clothes. And I think, and for all of us, that was, Michael, I see you nodding. I think for all of us, when the pandemic came, it was such a difficult time for us to think about the rest of our families, not to bring it home and not to spread it to our elderly family members as well. And just, getting home and showering first thing, and basically keeping yourself in this little bubble until you've gone in the shower. The one thing we know about this virus is it's easily washable, and it's easily killable with alcohol or sanitizers or soap. So sort of until you're cleansed when you come home, I don't interact with the rest of my family. And then the separation of clothes, I think about that.
What about you?
Michael,
go ahead.
No, I echo what Paul says. I'll leave my clothes in the garage and shower before any hugs are distributed to my family. I always just think of this triad of, masks, social distancing, and hand washing. And that's something everyone can do. I mentioned I keep hand sanitizer in my vehicle. I have it in my little backpack I carry with me. It's always available. I'm always washing my hands. And if everyone just did that and wore a mask, social distance, and most people I can say are doing that, and just adding, frequent hand washing, and you'll keep safe and you'll keep others safe.
thing. So Madhav, what's going on in the United States in your area? What are your doctors, nurses, frontline workers are doing to protect their families and friends?
Well, you know, I can see that there is this awareness that this is a serious illness. So people are taking it seriously. And whenever I go to the grocery store or any place I go to, people are always wearing masks. In my opinion, in the town that I live in, there is 100% compliance in terms of masking. So that's not a problem. But the problem is, you know, social gathering, small gatherings at homes. So that probably will improve. And, you know, people realize that it's not going to happen to them or their family. And when they talk to their friends and family members, they were surprised to see there are so many of these friends and families have been affected. So I think the awareness is there and things are definitely improving.
Great, thank you. So next is a comment from Pam Russell. Thank you for doing this information session. Do you know when our frontline healthcare workers in Northumberland will be getting their COVID vaccination? Pam, everybody in the area is working really hard because we don't have a date yet, but soon to come. I would say the sooner the better. All of us, and I think Linda might be on the line, our president CEO, she has been immensely active in trying to get vaccinations, not just to the healthcare workers, but to our entire community. Next is a question from Kamlesh. How risky is grocery shopping? Anybody wants to take that? Oh,
sure. I can take that since I kind of brought it up. Yeah. I think about it as risky. Maybe that's just me. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. It just means that you have to be careful and be vigilant, right? Like I said, I sort of treat grocery shopping as going into the hospital. I don't touch my face. I sanitize my hands before and after. It's impossible to really be completely careful inside the store because people touch things and they put things back down on the shelf and they sneeze on things, and that's just reality. But as long as you think of yourself and your family and you wash your hands before and after you enter in the vehicle, before and after you handle groceries, and as long as you're vigilant and you're keeping your mask on and not touching your face and putting it under your nose and, you know, scratching your nose and putting it back on in the grocery store, I think it's a risk that we all have to take, and therefore we just be vigilant.
Now, we looked for studies and others what is the risk of transmission in different settings? And it's not clear, but clearly touching your face with your hands, no matter where you are and unknown, is really where the risk is. Selena Forsett asks, any truth to the rumor that we should all be taking large doses of vitamin D and I'm assuming it is to prevent COVID? So I can take that one. I have looked for things, what can prevent, and there's literally no chemical form and there's no science. And yes, we might be deficient in vitamin D in general when we are north of a certain latitude and we don't get enough sunlight. And if we are all, you know, isolating at home, we might get deficient of vitamin D, but vitamin D has no connection yet proven that it will prevent us from getting COVID. Next one is to Madhav. Madhav, as a survivor, has your philosophy to life changed? And what will you advise us?
Well, you know, my philosophy has changed because I never thought that I would get sick like this. And we always feel that, you know, I'm in an excellent health, I exercise regularly, and this is not going to happen to me. So that is the big wake-up call for me when I got ill. So the message is, you know, always be vigilant and follow the guidelines. And to add to the other things that you said, there are no real preventive measures other than masking and social distancing. Zinc and vitamin D, vitamin C, none None of those things have proven to be of any benefit, either to prevent the disease or to slow down the disease.
Okay, great. And then there's a question, you know, and Paul, this is how engaged our audience is. Jennifer said, for what it's worth, I've heard several infection control experts say that risk of picking it up from groceries and other services is very low. So I'd say, yes, it is very low. But, you know, one of the things, Jennifer, we do is we share what is out there and what the opinion or what we are doing personally. Even in my family, there's a difference in opinion between us brothers and others to how do we go about doing things. So that is there. And as Kamle said, I've doubled my dose of vitamin D mostly because I'm not going out because I'm not seeing the sunlight. So I'm doubling it up, not for COVID purposes. Okay, so I don't see any questions in the chat box anymore. Any other questions, people can unmute or come up, and we have come up to exactly 1 hour. So we are running like a clock. So no, I don't see any. So now I would say to all of our panelists, Paul, Michael, Madhav, this has been very useful. It has been, it is very telling. And yes, the vaccine will help us, but then the day that we are vaccinated, we are not going to throw away. There's not going to be a victory day that if all the people at NHH are vaccinated, that we'll say, okay, no, now you can come and do whatever you want to. Some of these infection control practices are here to stay. So let's not lose our patience. The clear messages are distancing, masking, beyond, and things can get worse quickly. So don't ignore your symptoms. And I would put in a special plug for if you have a sickness that is not COVID related, do not ignore your symptoms. Do come see Paul and his team in the emergency room because we worry about people who have delayed presentations because it is just more complicated to deal with these things. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll continue these sessions. The next one will be on the third Wednesday of February, same time, 5:30, and we'll announce it. And Jennifer, any closing comments from you? Jennifer Gillard is the from NHH. She is the backbone of getting these out with Jennifer Gilmore and her team. So any thoughts, Jennifer?
Just want to say thanks very much, Dr. Bhargava. You did a wonderful job facilitating this conversation. And I would recommend that everyone follow our website, pacetalks.com. We'll be announcing the next talks there. And of course, following the social media feeds of all of our partners. And we'll keep you posted on the next one. Thanks for joining.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good night and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.